You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the August 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here are some of this month's contributors. K. Austin Collins, The Idris Experience. Idris was a fun hang, Vanity Fair's film critic says of this month's cover subject. I'm extremely fond of his work as Stringer Bell on The Wire, but seeing him imitate a frying egg was pretty fun. Collins also writes crosswords for The New York Times and The New Yorker. Tierney Giron, The Coast of Utopia. Giron was touched by the authenticity of the surfer moms she photographed in Byron Bay, Australia. I instantly connected with the girls, she says. With social media, you can make something look like one thing, when in reality, it is another. But it was just genuine, beautiful moments that melted one into the next. Bethany McLean, Bitter Pill. I was struck by David Sackler's willingness to speak out, despite resistance from his family, says McLean, a Vanity Fair contributing editor, and by how he believes that if he can tell his family's side of things, he can change the perception of them. McLean's new podcast, Making a Killing, is available on Luminary. Joel Stein, Hollywood and Divine. For his forthcoming book, In Defense of Elitism, Stein attended church in Texas, in the county with the highest percentage of Trump voters. But for this month's column on L.A.'s hipster churches, he didn't need to go far. This was right where I lived, he says, and everyone was younger and cooler than me. Karina Chocano, The Coast of Utopia. Trying to locate a way of life that exists on Instagram was strange, Chocano says, of her time with social media savvy surfer moms in Australia. But talking to them together was a nice communal moment. The friendships are real. Her book, You Play the Girl, won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Criticism in 2018. Thank you. From Editor-in-Chief Radhika Jones comes this month's editor's letter, Breaking Waves. In the photo, Meryl Streep, Reese Witherspoon, Radhika Jones, Nicole Kidman, and Laura Dern at the Wing Soho in New York City for a Big Little Lies panel discussion in May. I remember when it was possible, at least in theory, to spend the summer catching up. Summer was the slow season, the sultry season, the season of reruns. It's not like that anymore. The days stretch out before us, but they overflow with new things to see. Chernobyl, check. Fleabag season 2, check. When They See Us, check. Women's World Cup, ongoing, check. Democratic primary debates, check, check, check. In advance of the second season of Big Little Lies, I interviewed 4 of its stars at the women's collective The Wing in Manhattan. Sunday nights will be appointment viewing through late July because I cannot miss 1 minute of Meryl Streep in the performance of a lifetime being salty to Reese Witherspoon. But the dream of slowing down and catching up lives on at Vanity Fair, where we propose summer as the season of sizzle, scandal, surfing, swing, and schadenfreude. Stories to while away a leisurely weekend at the beach. The sizzle comes from our cover star, Idris Elba, he who is often rumored to be the next James Bond, except that James Bond is not nearly smooth enough, cool enough, hot enough to be Idris. The scandal is the opioid crisis in America and its connection to the pharma baron Sackler dynasty, about which David Sackler speaks here for the first time. The surf rolls into Byron Bay, New South Wales, Australia, where a group of glowy mamas and their insta-perfect progeny are perfecting the aspirational art of authentic living through social media, and being handsomely rewarded for it. Swing, the wave of women instrumentalist in jazz, the new top brass, if you will, upending the age-old boys' club. The schadenfreude takes root in Greenwich, Connecticut, where a hedge fund manager who got on the wrong side of the Southern District of New York returns after serving jail time, only to find himself less than welcome on the charity circuit. Turns out, he prefers the camaraderie of inmates to the mean scene of the moneyed elite. They may seem like the perfect stories for summer. The waves of Byron Bay beckon to where the living is easy. That siren call you hear is the low note of the saxophone, but really they're seasonless. It's high time to escape, any way we can, if not in real life, then at least in the pages of a magazine. On to news about style, discotheque. Louis Vuitton's exultant new collection revels in 1980s Paris, but the here and now still pushes through, by Eva Dixit. With photograph by Travis Rathbone of the Louis Vuitton Dauphin Mini monogram LV Pop Bleu. In Eric Rohmer's 80s classic La Nuit de la Pleine Lune, Full Moon in Paris, a young design intern, Louise Pascal Auger, cohabitates with her much older architect boyfriend, Remy Cecchicario, in a soulless gray apartment complex on the suburban outskirts of Paris. Square of jaw and personality, Remy plays tennis far too early in the morning and is terrible company at the late-night parties Louise adores. She's torn between the imagined stability offered by her older, albeit stodgier male companion, whom she thinks she loves, and the electric possibilities of freedom found on her solo nights out. The romantic comedy is notable not just for its sublime decor, sparse aesthetics pre-IKEA, fruit bowls as apartment accents before every Soho retailer copped the idea, but even more so for how it captures a very specific phase of 20-something restlessness that transcends generations and economies. As true of today's world-weary millennials as it was of the young gauche caviar Parisians of 1984, it's no surprise that Nicolas Ghesquiere chose this particular time and city, early 80s Paris, bubbling with the promise of endless love, sex, and adventure, to plunder for Louis Vuitton's Fall-Winter 2019 show, presented as a testament to 80s excess and nostalgia, swathed liberally with 80s sequins and shoulders, and capped off with Pat McGrath's 80s contouring to match. In the blue and purple frock, with billowing sleeves and a pierrot-bib collar, or the uniform-like outerwear with an aggressively cinched waist, it is impossible not to see the spirit of La Nuit de la Pleine Lune in the clothes Ghesquiere sent down his Paris runway, which evokes the broad mohair coat that envelops Auger's slight frame, the giant tulle bow perched atop her bouffant. The extensive leather work and clashing solid colors, Ghesquiere said, were inspired by his memories of people watching from cafes in the Beaubourg district around the Centre Pompidou. Those were the days when, he intimates, assorted subcultures, street dancers, museum-goers, goths, punks, fashion devotees intermingled on the street, long before Instagram steamrolled trends and social tribes into a performance for a digital void. With the oblivious didacticism in which men of artistry and wisdom often get lost, Ghesquiere would like you to look up from your phones and take in the clothes, not remembering, perhaps, that in that same decade of analog pleasures, the foundation was being laid for the technological innovation that fuels life today. Beyond the party Polaroids and legendary clubs, the 1980s were also what the designer Pierre Hardy called, in the New York Times, the last period that believed in the future, one that brought a rudimentary but functional online connectivity to the French, who enthusiastically embraced online travel, banking, entertainment, and porn long before the rest of the world did. Take Ghesquiere's new Dauphin bag, its squat shape and blue CMYK offset print mimic the screen of the pre-internet Minitel, a groundbreaking device known as La Petite Boîte Marron, the little brown box, that heralded a France-wide web and led President Jacques Chirac to taunt, "Today, a baker in Aubervilliers knows perfectly how to check his bank account on the Minitel." Can the same be said of the baker in New York? The subcultures of Gesquer's inspiration could thrive in part because theirs was a world where living itself was an act of escapism, when the idea of tomorrow was one in which the non-negotiable foundations of life had not yet been eroded. Today, the myth of this excessive past feels as foreign as the idea of a future in which the oceans won't rise to ravage our towns. For carefree Louise of Romer's Comedy, the solution to her highly relatable dilemma of romantic ambivalence comes in her decision to maintain a second apartment in Paris, where she can crash after partying, a situation that creates more problems than it solves, and explains the film's cryptic epigram, "He who has two women loses his soul. He who has two houses loses his mind." But those of us viewing today, to whom this solution seems frankly inconceivable, we retreat into the solace of our screens to watch and rewatch distant spectacles like the Louis Vuitton show, in which visions of leather skullcaps and checkered skirts cascade down not the Centre Pompidou itself, but rather a replica of its courtyard recreated within the actual Louvre. In his sly scolding and impassioned exhortations for us to get off our phones, Gesquer forgot, or pretends to forget, that no stunt thrives better on screen than engineered nostalgia. This is where we do our people watching in 10-second tap-throughs. This is where we relive the myths of past and luxuries that we cannot know.
Thank you.
From the Hive Report, Better Haves, a deep dive on a shallow subject. If politics makes for a game of assortative mating, these potential first spouses have already hit the 2020 jackpot. Candidate Donald Trump. Melania Trump is his third wife. They married in 2005. Defining trait, intimidating footwear. Signature achievement, secret prenup. Political superpower, ironic anti-cyberbullying campaign. Electoral kryptonite, see above. Favorite pastime, locking herself in the East Wing. Grand ambition, billion-dollar divorce. Sign of human frailty, fondness for polarizing outerwear. Historical precedent, Anne Boleyn. Celebrity doppelganger, Jennifer Coolidge. Candidate, Pete Buttigieg. Chasten Buttigieg is his first husband, married, 2018. Defining trait, Harry Potter eyewear. Signature achievement, taught us to pronounce Buttigieg. Political superpower, encyclopedic meme knowledge. Electoral kryptonite, functional Twitter addiction. Favorite pastime, canine documentarian. Grand ambition, 2020 Teen Choice Award. Sign of human frailty, unreconstructed Game of Thrones fan. Historical precedent, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. Celebrity doppelganger, Frankie Muniz. Candidate, Bernie Sanders. Jane Sanders, second wife, married, 1988. Defining trait, sturdy cardigans. Signature achievement, Soviet travel connoisseur. Political superpower, radioactive waste disposal expert. Electoral kryptonite, former FBI person of interest. Favorite pastime, suspected maple tapping. Grand ambition, education secretary. Sign of human frailty, setting Burlington College on a death spiral. Historical precedent, Mary Todd Lincoln. Celebrity doppelganger, Kathy Bates. Candidate, Kamala Harris. Douglas Emhoff, first husband, married, 2014. Defining trait, wife paparazzo. Signature achievement, represented the Taco Bell Chihuahua. Political superpower, human heart eye emoji. Electoral kryptonite, gratuitous airport selfies. Favorite pastime, sporting bespoke suits. Grand ambition, Instagram influencer. Sign of human frailty, follicular retrenchment. Historical precedent, Dennis Thatcher. Celebrity doppelganger, Gary Cohn. Candidate, Cory Booker. Rosario Dawson, first known boo, confirmed, 2019. Defining trait, former Bernie Sanders apologist. Signature achievement, kids, 1995. Political superpower, fluent in TMZ. Electoral kryptonite, getting arrested by Capitol Police. Favorite pastime, saving the turtles. Grand ambition, Nobel Peace Prize. Sign of human frailty, Josie and the Pussycats, 2001. Historical precedent, Nancy Reagan. Celebrity doppelganger, Rosario Dawson. Higher Power by Joel Stein, Hollywood and Divine, Searching for Salvation, and The Authentic in L.A.'s booming hipster ministries. Opening photo illustration by Selman Hoskar, Chad Veach, Judah Smith, Kanye West, Joseph Barkley, Chris Pratt, Justin Bieber, Erwin McManus, and Angela Davis. Shown here standing in front of a theater with a stained glass window. I am in the mosh pit of West Hollywood's El Rey Theater, jangly from two cups of Zoe Ministries' excellent self-branded coffee. 20-20-somethings in mom jeans, sneakers, and colorful baggy shirts are singing Disney radio-inflected anthems about God while we gently shoulder-bump one another. Soon, preacher Chad Veach takes the stage in a baseball cap, rainbow-hued kicks, and a denim jacket that says Veach on the back. He bounces on the balls of his feet, referring to Jesus' disciples as his crew. Whenever he says anything vaguely profound, people yell, "Wow," which is the amen of cool young churches. Veach warns the first row they're going to get wet from his spit. He's preaching pure Pentecostalism, and I'm prepared for snake handling, for speaking in tongues, for a deaf man to hear and then say that the music here is a little generic. Veach is part of the new Great Awakening. Interest in Christianity is blossoming in America's biggest, bluest cities, partly promoted by celebrity Zoe-goers such as Chris Pratt and Katherine Schwarzenegger. Young people listen to Spotify list of songs performed by the bands at one-name churches that sound like rehab centers. Hillsong, a global megachurch that started in Australia. Mosaic, VU, Radius, Church Home. The center of this great awakening is Los Angeles, where the word comes in many denominations. In January, Kanye West started hosting Sunday service, at which Tyler, the Creator, Katy Perry, Orlando Bloom, Kid Cudi, DMX, and 070 Shake have listened to him sing about God. On Easter, West built a hill on a fenced-in area attached to the Coachella Music Festival, joining in with a chorus in matching mauve ponchos. Halfway through the service, Veach, who likes to say that Zoe is pronounced Zoe like Beyonce, slows his sermon down. His 34-year-old brother-in-law, he informs the crowd, was supposed to preach this Sunday for the first time, but he had a stroke while on vacation with his family and died. It's shocking and tragic. And then Veach reveals that his daughter, Georgia, who has an incurable brain disorder that will likely prevent her from ever walking or talking, got more disheartening news. He has a G tattoo in her honor, as do Zoe regulars Justin Bieber, Hailey Baldwin, Selena Gomez, and Ashley Benson. The sermon suddenly feels authentic. There is a man in front of me grappling with his faith. Then I realize that all that has preceded this, the merch giveaway from children's pastor Tommy Two Guns, the number for automatic text tithing, the promo video that looked like it was for the next Saw, was equally authentic to these young Angelenos. When Veach asked the non-believers to accept Jesus, nearly 200 raised their hands. I want to lift my atheist arm, to feel whatever they're feeling, but my hand won't go, which makes me wonder if God is real and is keeping me honest. As I leave, a millennial couple ask if I was at Radius, another cool church, this morning. I had indeed drunk freshly ground third-wave coffee there as Pastor Joseph Barkley The tattooed former lead singer of a worship band called Plumline asked us to write a wish for God on a construction paper leaf and affix it to a wall. I wrote, "I want to believe," on mine. On the leaf next to mine, someone had written, "Sick people get Yeezys and get better." The pair who approached me, L.A. newcomers Alexa and Evan Henderson, are great awakening devotees. They rock out to church band CDs, listen to the church's podcast, and say things such as, "We want it real." Church home pastor Judah Smith, like his friend Veach, a veteran of Seattle's Pentecostal scene, tells me that young people are thirsty for both authenticity and spirituality. They have access to their heroes and know that they're disconnected, too. We are going, "Geez, if Kanye is not happy being Kanye, we're all screwed," he says, over egg whites at an outside table at Jones on 3rd in Studio City. As he's talking, he spots his bro Ryan Good walking by, wearing a sweatshirt he designed himself with a photo of the late rapper Nipsey Hussle. Good was Bieber's swagger coach and started the Drew House clothing line with him. "I hated him at first," says Good, about meeting Smith backstage at a Bieber show in Everett, Washington. "I had a perception that pastors are weird guys trying to be cool. They pop up on tour. It's more prevalent since celebrity pastors became cool." After some encouragement from Bieber, the two became friends, and Smith began flying to L.A. from Seattle, where he still runs the church on Sundays and pastors the Seahawks, to conduct a weekday Bible class at the home of Good's friend, E! News host Jason Kennedy. When they attracted so many faithful that the cops broke it up, they moved to increasingly larger venues until it became a church, filling the Saban Theater, a 2,000-seat Art Deco venue in Beverly Hills. Like Veach and other Great Awakening pastors, Smith is trying to make church less unapproachably country club. "What's so sacred about Sunday, a tabernacle, or a stained glass window?" he asked. If he and Veach and so many other preachers were raised on hip-hop, isn't it authentic to talk like that? To play that music? To dress in streetwear? In March, a church-going tech guy in Texas started documenting preachers' expensive clothes in an Instagram account called @preachersandsneakers, which now has nearly 170,000 followers and a spin-off podcast. It exposes the prosperity gospel implied by this new breed of ministries. Tithe to your church, and God will rain Gucci sweatpants on your soul. "I felt so sad that I dishonored Jesus," says the dean of cool L.A. preachers, Mosaic pastor Irwin McManus, 60, after @preachersandsneakers called him out for wearing a $1,000 pair of Air Jordan 1 retro highs. "My kids were the opposite. They're like, 'Dad, you need to wear something really dope on stage, because you cannot be controlled by people.'" McManus, who once ran a fashion line, started many of the cool church trends, such as preaching from a stool. He held his services at a dance club. He got rid of words such as church and sermon. "Even with the Bible, I call it the scriptures, because I feel like it feels more sacred. Bible sounds more like Bible Belt, Southern, and conservative." McManus, who is not Pentecostal, is a longtime TED donor and attendee. His Easter sermon included the phrases "black holes" and "a universe ever expanding." Last he checked, a fifth of the Mosaic attendees were atheist. His service felt warm and artistic, not preachy. I enjoyed it, as well as his books and the great blue bottle coffee Mosaic served. But I confessed that I didn't feel anything. I couldn't raise my hand when he asked people to proclaim their conversion. Over coffee 3 days later, McManus considers my dilemma and says, Can I get you to go to a Soul Cycle class? A week later, I am cranking my legs to the commands of Mosaic member and spin instructor Angela Davis, sister of Jerry Lorenzo, the founder of the label Fear of God, who created looks for Bieber on his Purpose World Tour. A few weeks earlier, Ciara, a regular at Church Home, performed live during this class, but today we are listening to pre-recorded hip-hop. Your best life is not for sale. You have to earn it, Davis keeps repeating as we sweat. By surrounding myself with people of faith, McManus has told me, I can open myself up to feeling it. So I invite the Hendersons, the cool church aficionados, to Church Home with me. I grab a delicious ritual coffee in the lobby, and within a few minutes, Pastor Judah Smith appears in glasses and a tan corduroy jacket designed by Drew House. He takes a stool, prefacing Luke 7:18-23 with, This is so Jesus. After he finishes, a band sings out, Even when I can't feel it, you're working. I close my eyes and raise my palm outward to heaven, along with everyone around me, hoping to feel something. And I do. Evan Henderson has put his hand on my back. It feels strange being touched by a relative stranger, but it feels good, too, like we're feeling something together, even if we're feeling different things. I don't feel God, but I don't feel alone either. It's the most I've ever felt in a religious setting. And I believe, I truly do believe, that it is authentic. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Malala Yousafzai, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Malala Fund founder and author of We're Displaced, talks nail-biting and pesky brothers. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Being grateful for what you have. What is your greatest fear? Losing my family and fear that the world won't become a better place. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Anyone who has struggled. Which living person do you most admire? Women in leadership positions in every field who are using their advantages to inspire younger women. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Biting my nails. What is the trait you most deplore in others? I hate it when my little brothers don't close their mouths when they're eating. What is your greatest extravagance, walking in the gardens or by a river in Oxford? What is your favorite journey? When I travel to a country and I know that being there will raise awareness of the issues girls who live there are facing. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Perfection. Happiness doesn't mean having fun every day. What do you dislike most about your appearance? My height. Which living person do you most despise? That's something I don't even think about. My mind never goes there. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Mate. What is your greatest regret? I haven't reached the point where I look back. I'm still thinking, what's next? What or who is the greatest love of your life? My family. When and where are you happiest? When I meet girls and see hope in their eyes, despite all the difficulties they are facing. Which talent would you most like to have? Too many. Singing, drawing, painting, dancing. Any of these, I wouldn't refuse. What is your current state of mind? Happy. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I'm trying to be more organized. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? Fix my brothers. Those two need a lot of work. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Changing the conversation about girls' secondary education. What is your most treasured possession? My memories. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Living under terrorism and being displaced from your home. Where would you like to live? Pakistan or the UK on a sunny day? What is your favorite occupation? Teaching. What is your most marked characteristic? Honesty. What is the quality you most like in a man? Respect and awareness that they have a role to play in the fight for equality. What is the quality you most like in a woman? A woman who knows she's capable of doing anything. What do you most value in your friends? They treat me as a regular person. Who are your heroes in real life? Martin Luther King Jr., Benazir Bhutto, Bhasha Khan, Gandhi, my teachers. What are your favorite names? My mother's name, Tur Pekai. What is it that you most dislike? Morning alarms telling me it's time to get up. How would you like to die? In peace. What is your motto? Keep on going. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Malala Yousafzai. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.